Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program with support from the Boston University Center for the Humanities and the Latin American Studies Program. Our speaker is Dr. Kia Caldwell, Associate Professor of African, African American, and Diaspora Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Dr. Caldwell's lecture is titled The Alini Case, an Intersectional Analysis of Gender, Race, and the Human Right to Health in Brazil. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, African American Studies Program Director John Thornton.
This is Kia Caldwell. She has a degree in Spanish Literature and Civilization from Princeton, and she got an MA in Latin American Studies and a PhD in Social Anthropology from UTA, or Texas at Austin. And she's presently an associate professor of African, African-American, and Diaspora Studies, and adjunct associate professor of anthropology at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She's also the director of faculty diversity initiatives at the College of Arts and Sciences, one of the overworked roles that we're now hearing about for people of African ancestry in the university. And she's recently published a book, Negros in Brazil. I guess you pronounce the Negros as Portuguese and the rest of it's just English, right? All right. Negros in Brazil, Re-envisioning Black Women, Citizenship, and the Politics of Identity, Rutgers University Press, 2007. She's been the co-editor of a number of publications, Gendered Citizenships, Transnational Perspectives on Knowledge Production, Political Activism, and Culture, which was a part of Palgrave Macmillan's Comparative Feminist Studies series in 2009. And she has a new book, Intersectional Health Equity, which is what she's going to be talking about some today, Gender, Race, and Policy Engagements in Brazil, is forthcoming from University of Illinois Press. So she's also the co-director of the African Diaspora Fellows Program, which provides professional development in African, African-American, and Afro-Latin studies to middle and high school teachers in North Carolina. So I call that doing the Lord's work, really, because we desperately need to get high school students to learn about Latin America, to learn about Africa, to learn about African Americans. It's something that's dropped off dramatically in the past few years, and hopefully we can begin to come back with that. Dr. Caldwell has received grants and fellowships from UNC Chapel Hill, Center for AIDS Research, the American Psychological Association, the Mellon Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Library of Congress. So I'd now like to give you Kia Caldwell.
Thank you for coming out. So the title of my talk is The Alini Case, Maternal Mortality, Intersectional Discrimination, and the Human Right to Health in Brazil. In 2002, Alini da Silva Pimentel Teixeira, a 28-year-old Afro-Brazilian woman, died following complications resulting from a stillbirth that was inadequately treated at a health center. A resident of the city of Belford Horseshoe, which is located in the metropolitan region of Rio de Janeiro, Alini Pimentel was 27 weeks pregnant when she sought medical treatment at a health center for vomiting and strong abdominal pain. The doctor prescribed medication for nausea, B12 vitamins, and a topical medication for a vaginal infection. Her symptoms worsened, causing her to return to the health center 2 days later. An ultrasound was performed which showed that the fetus was dead. Labor was induced, however, doctors did not perform surgery to remove the placenta until 14 hours later. All of this was done at a private health clinic, which was not adequately equipped or staffed for emergency obstetric procedures. Following removal of the placenta, Alini Pimentel began to hemorrhage, vomit blood, and her blood pressure dropped. The medical staff then decided to transfer her to a public hospital in the region. However, only one hospital would accept her, and it refused to send its only ambulance in the evening to transport her. The family was also unable to obtain assistance from a private ambulance service. Alini Pimentel waited 8 hours for an ambulance and manifested clinical symptoms of a coma during the final 2 hours prior to being transported to the hospital. The health center that was treating her did not send her medical records to the hospital, so the hospital staff did not know her clinical state or the fact that she had recently been pregnant. When she arrived at the hospital, Alini was hypothermic, had acute respiratory distress, her blood pressure had dropped to zero, and she had to be resuscitated. She was also placed in the hallway of the emergency room due to the lack of an available bed, eventually staying in the hallway for 21 hours without being treated. Eleni died the following day. 5 days passed between the initial onset of her illness and her death. The circumstances leading to Eleni Pimentel's death highlight gross inadequacies and failures in the quality of maternity care and emergency obstetric care provided to poor Afro-descendant women in Brazil. My presentation today draws from my current book project, and this presentation uses Eleni da Silva Pimentel's 2002 death as a case study to examine the relationship between intersecting forms of discrimination and human rights violations. I interrogate how the legal case that Eleni's family pursued highlights the intersectional relationship among gender, race, and class in shaping Afro-Brazilian women's vulnerability to maternal death. I also analyzed the legal significance of the 2011 decision made by the Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, also known as CEDAW, in response to Eleni's death. Through examination of the CEDAW Committee's decision, I highlight the potential benefits that can be gained from using a human rights framework to address discrimination against Afro-descendant women in the health sector. My analysis also links healthcare discrimination to issues of structural violence and genocide in Afro-Brazilian communities, and underscores the importance of developing intersectional frameworks to challenge human rights violations in African descendant communities throughout the Americas. My view of intersectionality is informed by the work of U.S. Black feminist scholars such as Kimberly Crenshaw and Patricia Hill Collins, who for nearly three decades have argued for the importance of acknowledging and examining the ways in which multiple forms of social identity and social experience connect, overlap, and are co-constructed. In recent years, an increasing number of researchers have also begun to examine the importance of intersectional perspectives in the field of public health. However, links between intersectionality, health, and human rights have rarely been made, especially as they relate to the experiences of African descendant women in the Americas. And just to give you a little bit of background on Brazil, are some people familiar with Brazil? Sort of, right? So Brazil did have the longest history of slavery in the Americas. It abolished slavery in 1888, so it was the last country in the Americas to abolish slavery. And according to the 2010 census, slightly over 50% of the population self-identified as being either preto, which means black, or pardo, which means brown or mixed. At least half the population is of African descent. And then if we think about Afro-descendant women or quote-unquote black women, they constitute approximately 25% of the total population. Now, thinking about maternal mortality in Brazil, the World Health Organization defines maternal death as, quote, the death of a woman while pregnant or within 42 days of termination of pregnancy, irrespective of the duration and site of the pregnancy, from any cause related to or aggravated by the pregnancy or its management, but not from accidental or incidental causes. The World Health Organization has estimated that 8,700 women died from complications related to pregnancy and childbirth in Brazil during 2000. Brazil also accounted for over one-third of all maternal deaths in Latin America at this time. Statistics on maternal mortality rates in Brazil are markedly unreliable and do not accurately reflect maternal mortality trends in the country. This is largely because the statistics are not reliable and they've only been available for a few states. And the states, out of 26 states and also the Federal District of Brasilia, until recently, reliable vital statistics were only available for 8 states, so 8 out of 26. And all of these states are in the southeast, south, or west central regions of the country, which tend to be the more developed regions economically. In addition, since 1980, a variety of different methods have been used to calculate maternal death, and the rates have likely gone up in more recent data due to audits that are conducted by maternal death committees in Brazil. So really, when we think about underreporting and also misclassification of maternal deaths, both of these things have made it difficult to develop an accurate sense of how many maternal deaths occur in Brazil, and they also suggest that the officially reported numbers are grossly underestimated. It has been argued that for every reported maternal death in Brazil, one goes unreported. So essentially, researchers and also the Ministry of Health use what's called a correction factor, and they typically multiply the number of maternal deaths by at least 1.4, and in some cases, the number is multiplied by 2 to get a more accurate sense of how many maternal deaths are occurring. And another issue is that in many cases, things such as infections or cardiac arrest may be mentioned as a cause of death. However, the fact that these conditions were related to pregnancy may not be listed on a woman's death certificate or her records. It's also important to note that most maternal deaths in Brazil are due to avoidable causes. In recent years, researchers have begun to focus on the discrimination experienced by African descendant women during pregnancy and childbirth, which underscores the importance of acknowledging the racial as well as gender dimensions of their experiences in the healthcare sector. Health disparities experienced by African descendant women with respect to reproductive health and maternal mortality have been acknowledged in recent policies, such as the 2009 National Policy for Women's Comprehensive Health Care. However, this policy also highlights the importance of further research on the health needs of African descendant women, since research in this area is relatively new and is rarely done. Instead, research on women's health has tended to focus on class and poor or low-income women, rather than explicitly focusing on African descendant women, and has not typically included race as a variable. In addition, inconsistent collection of what's known as the Quesito Core, or data by race or skin color, in healthcare also has important implications for obtaining reliable data on maternal mortality rates by women of different groups, or among women of different groups. And so one of the issues in Brazil has been that within the healthcare sector, a patient's race or color historically has not been collected. And even though there's a law sort of mandating that this should happen, and that's been around since the 1990s, so we don't have very good data in terms of race and skin color within the health sector or in relationship to certain illnesses or causes of death. Research has shown that Negra, Black, and Parda, or brown women experience higher rates of pilgrimage. This term is pilgrimage is used to travel or travel to maternity hospitals while in labor. Brazilian researchers have used the term peregrinação or pilgrimage to describe the process by which women travel to more than one maternity hospital because they cannot receive treatment at them. So during labor, women often are not able to give birth at the first hospital they go to, so they may travel to several before being able to deliver their baby. One study by Maria do Carmo Leal and her colleagues found that 31.8% of negras, 28.8% of pardas, and 18.5% of brancas traveled to more than one maternity hospital in the municipality of Rio de Janeiro in order to give birth. Racial disparities in access to anesthesia during childbirth were also found, with 16.4% of pardas and 21.8% of negras not having access to anesthesia. Non-white women also tend to use public health establishments and those that have agreements with the SUS, which is Brazil's public health system, at higher rates for childbirth. In the same study, 58.9% of negras and 46.9% of pardas gave birth at public health establishments, while 43.7% of brancas, or white women, did. So according to Leal et al., almost a third of pardas and negras did not receive attention at the first establishment they sought out, and they received less anesthesia for vaginal birth. Wandering to maternity wards at the time of childbirth is one of the dimensions of a lack of a welcoming climate in health institutions and reflects the absence of systematic planning for birth assistance in the municipality of Rio de Janeiro, with harmful consequences for the mother and her offspring. Leal et al. Also found that racial and educational discrimination had a noticeable impact on the prenatal and childbirth experiences of low-income Black and brown women in Rio de Janeiro. Nationwide rates of maternal mortality in Brazil were found to be higher for preta, or Black women, in all age groups and were 3 times higher than those of white women in 2003. During the same year, regional rates of maternal mortality were markedly higher for pretas and pardas than brancas. In the southeastern, southern, and central west regions of Brazil, rates of maternal mortality were 2 to 3.5 times higher for pretas than brancas. In specific states, rates of maternal death were even higher. For example, in Alagoas, which is in northeastern Brazil, rates for pretas were 10 times higher than for brancas, and rates were 20 times higher in Espírito Santo, which is also in northeastern Brazil. A publication by the Brazilian Ministry of Health noted that pardas had the highest maternal mortality rates between 2000 and 2003 and accounted for 41.5% of maternal deaths in 2003. Another issue that really needs to be looked at more is the relationship between clandestine abortions and maternal mortality for African descendant women, because given the fact that abortion is illegal in Brazil, this pushes poor women into situations where they're often having clandestine abortions in unsafe conditions, which also leads to higher maternal mortality rates among African descendant, low-income African descendant women, whereas middle-class white women can go to doctors or more professionalized abortion clinics, although abortion is illegal. One study found that between 1999 and 2002, the maternal mortality rate due to abortion was 5.59 per 100,000 live births for brancas, 9.98 for pardas, and 36.23 for pretas. However, it should be noted that since spontaneous abortions or miscarriages are included under the category of abortion in government maternal mortality records, all of these abortions were not induced. Another study published in 2008 showed that the risk of maternal death due to abortion was markedly higher for negras and pardas than for brancas. The risk of maternal death due to pregnancies that end in abortion was also found to be 2.5 times higher for black women as compared to white women in this study. The same study showed that the decriminalization of abortion would permit the reduction of risks of complications and maternal mortality due to pregnancies that end in abortion. Alaerte Martins, who is a public health professional, researcher, and also the executive director of the Rede de Mulheres Negras do Paraná, the Black Women's Network of the state of Paraná, has argued that the higher rates of maternal mortality amongst Black women are linked to racism and prejudice. And this is a quote from her. "Racism and prejudice are so incrustada or encrusted in us that people learn to treat others in a pacote or bundle. This is reflected in maternal mortality and health care. The first who are cared for are those who are equal. Afterward, those who are different. Imagine in the hour of abortion." And here she didn't specify whether it was spontaneous or induced. "Black women are already discriminated against. In a situation of abortion, they are more discriminated against than white women. They will be the last of the last to be attended, leading to a higher risk of death." So essentially, what I've tried to do just now is to demonstrate some of the ways in which there are racial disparities in maternal mortality rates, and this is in Brazil, and this is something that has not often been acknowledged due to racial discourses in Brazil and the lack of really looking at race as a factor when it comes to health in the country. This slide shows some of the key regional and international developments related to maternal mortality, maternal death, really at the international level. So in 1979, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women was ratified by the UN, and Brazil is a signatory to that convention, to CEDAW. In 1987, the International Safe Motherhood Conference took place in Nairobi, Kenya, and the International Safe Motherhood Initiative was launched. In 1990, the Pan American Health Organization, PAHO, developed a regional action plan to reduce maternal mortality. In 1994, there was a UN International Conference on Population and Development, the ICPD, which took place in Cairo, Egypt, which continues to really be a marker in terms of feminist struggles for reproductive rights, reproductive autonomy. And then in 1999, there was a joint statement by the World Health Organization, UNICEF, and the UN Population Fund on maternal mortality. So I'll just read a quote from that joint statement. It said, "The right to life is a fundamental human right, implying not only the right to protection against arbitrary execution by the state, but also the obligations of governments to foster the conditions essential for life and survival. Human rights are universal and must be applied without discrimination on any grounds whatsoever, including sex. For women, human rights include access to services that will ensure safe pregnancy and childbirth." So we can see that there's been an ongoing and longstanding sort of mobilization around the issue of maternal health and maternal death, maternal mortality, as a real concern And maternal mortality is often considered to be a key indicator sort of the levels of development for a country in terms of women's access to reproductive health care and really how much their lives are valued, what their chances of sort of surviving childbirth, pregnancy and childbirth are. When we think about Brazil, there have also been a lot of developments, especially since the 1980s, the late 1980s. So at that time, the first maternal mortality committees were established, and these committees were formed throughout the country, especially in the 1990s, and they conduct maternal audits, which are audits of maternal deaths, to try to get at a more accurate number in terms of the number of women who are dying due to maternal mortality, and sort of correct for the underreporting and misclassification of maternal deaths. In 1994, a National Committee to Combat Maternal Mortality was established. And also during that year, the Ministry of Health designated May 28th the National Day to Reduce Maternal Mortality. And if we think about the sort of international momentum around maternal mortality, in 2000, maternal mortality was prioritized as part of the Millennium Development Goals. So maternal health was one of the Millennium Development Goals. And during that year, the Ministry of Health also instituted the Humanization of Prenatal and Birth Program. In 2004, under Brazil's previous president, President Lula, the National Pact for the Reduction of Maternal and Neonatal Mortality was launched, and the National Policy for Women's Comprehensive Healthcare was also launched. So this was an interesting time in terms of national policies and programs related to women's health and maternal health. In 2005, maternal mortality committees were found in all of the states throughout Brazil. There were 172 regional committees and 748 municipal committees. So there was an uptick in the number of committees investigating maternal deaths by this time. But one of the problems has been that these committees don't always meet. So they might kind of exist on paper, but they might not meet and they might not be active, which is a real challenge. And then in 2011, something called Rede Cegonha, or the Stork Network, was created. And that was one of the most recent developments. This was created during President Dilma Rousseff's first year in office, and she's Brazil's first female president. So this network was designed to increase women's access to prenatal care and lessen challenges associated with childbirth, particularly in public hospitals. One of the main goals of the program was to decrease the maternal mortality rate in Brazil, which was in line with the United Nations Millennium Development Goals. And so we can see the logo here of the Rede Cegonha and the fact that it's called a stork network. So it invokes this idea of a stork delivering a baby, and, you know, a woman is not really present there. So a good number of feminist activists and scholars criticized the Rede Cegonha as being a regressive response by Rousseff's administration to conservative, religious, and political forces. The notion of creating a stork network can also be seen as an effort to erase women's role in childbearing by perpetuating mythical ideas about reproduction that did not adequately address or expand reproductive rights. Rede Cegonha's emphasis on maternal health was also in line with the maternalist politics of conservative political sectors, which drew attention away from the widespread practice of unsafe and clandestine abortions by Brazilian women who did not have access to legal abortion. This perspective emphasized women's role as reproducers and did not engage with the public health consequences of abortion being illegal, most notably how this historically has led to high rates of maternal mortality and also morbidity in the country. So as we think about the death of Aline da Silva Pimentel, this is the broader context in terms of Brazil and sort of international norms and mobilization around maternal mortality. So it is very important to recognize the ways in which her death highlights the precarious and unsafe health conditions that many poor African descendant women face in Brazil. Following Pimentel's death, the Center for Reproductive Rights, an international legal advocacy organization based here in New York, not here, but in the U.S., engaged in an 8-year battle on behalf of her family. Pimentel's mother was also represented by a Brazilian NGO called Advocacia Cidadã pelos Direitos Humanos, which means citizenship advocacy for human rights. The Center for Reproductive Rights submitted a shadow letter on the case in July 2007 to the CEDAW committee and filed a brief for the Alini case in November of 2007. So we can see there was kind of transnational mobilization around this case that was really important. The CEDAW committee, which I also refer to as the committee, issued a ruling in the case Alini da Silva Pimentel v. Brazil on August 10, 2011, finding that the Brazilian state violated, quote, the right to life enshrined in Article 6 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the right to effective protection of women's rights, and the right to health under the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. The committee found that the Brazilian government, quote, had not ensured access to quality medical treatment during delivery and to timely emergency obstetric care, implicating the right to non-discrimination based on gender and race. The inability of her family to obtain reparations from the state party violated the right to effective protection. In addition, according to the CEDAW committee, with regard to the existence of discrimination, insofar as the case involves an Afro-Brazilian woman from the urban periphery, the state party highlights the fact that the technical report prepared by the audit department of the health system found no evidence of discrimination. However, the state party does not rule out the possibility that discrimination may have contributed to some extent, but not decisively to the event. Rather, the convergence or association of the set of elements described may have contributed to the failure to provide necessary and emergency care to Ms. da Silva Pimentel Teixeira, resulting in her death. The committee criticized the Brazilian government for its, quote, rhetorical recognition of the problem of maternal mortality and noted that it had failed to meet its obligation to guarantee women's right to life and health. The committee further noted that the high rates of maternal mortality in the state party constitute a systematic failure to prioritize and protect women's basic human rights. The preventable death, maternal death of Ms. da Silva Pimentel Teixeira clearly exemplifies this failure. So this was a long document, and it touched on several things. It talked about the grossly negligent health care that was provided to Alini, and it said that it constituted a form of de facto gender discrimination under CEDAW. And it also found that the city of Belford Horseshoe had inadequate maternal health services, which constituted a violation of the right to non-discrimination again. The CEDAW committee also argued that the, quote, fact that the population of the city is largely of African descent further compounds this situation. So I have been really drawn to the ways in which this decision talks about race and talks about intersecting forms of discrimination. So if we think about the last quote here, which points out the racial composition of the city of Belford Horseshoe, the terminology here expanded the gender-focused definition of discrimination in CEDAW to include related forms of inequality, as well as differential treatment and discrimination, such as those based on race and ethnicity. Recognizing other forms of inequality was especially significant given Alini's background as an African descendant woman. However, it is also important to note that this conceptualization of multiple forms of inequality and discrimination did not reflect an explicitly intersectional approach. Instead, it seemed to be based on an additive or compounded model. Later in the decision, the committee adopted a more intersectional approach, recognizing that Alini experienced multiple forms of discrimination and arguing that she was discriminated on the basis of sex, as well as being a woman of African descent, and due to her socioeconomic background. The committee's recommendations called for the Brazilian government to provide adequate reparation to Alini's surviving mother and daughter, including adequate financial compensation commensurate with the gravity of the violations against her. This was very important since Alini was an important source of income for her family, and her husband left the family after her death. As a result, her mother was forced to raise Alini's daughter in extremely impoverished conditions. So this issue of reparations was very, very important. And it's something that civil society, a lot of activists, feminist activists, black women activists, organized around for several years because the Brazilian government did not respond to the call for reparations for several years. And this is an example of some of the sort of materials that were put out there as part of the reparations campaign. And they talked about human rights, and then we could see there was a hashtag, Justiça Aline, Justice for Aline. And this was sponsored by the Secretariat of Human Rights and Secretariat for Policies for Women, which have since been combined, by the way. Right. So in September, Dilma Rousseff combined the Secretariat for Racial Equality Policies, the Secretariat for Women, and the Secretariat for Human Rights, which has kind of changed things in Brazil. But after 3 years of sustained pressure from feminist health activists and civil society organizations, on February 28, 2014, the CEDAW committee backed an agreement between the Brazilian government and the Center for Reproductive Rights on the monetary compensation that would be given to Aline's mother. Individual reparations for Aline's daughter were still pending after this agreement. The CEDAW committee also underscored that follow-up dialogue would continue regarding its other recommendations, particularly the reparations for Aline's daughter. In addition, a legal decision was still pending in the Brazilian courts at this time. On March 25th of 2014, a ceremony was held in Brasilia, the capital of Brazil, to recognize the payment of reparations to Aline's mother, who received indemnification in the amount of 131,000 reais on March 17th, 2014. So there were photos posted online of this reparation ceremony with some of the top ministers and sort of government officials on that day. There were also three significant symbolic forms of reparation that were scheduled to take place in April of 2014. So, for example, the intensive care unit of a maternity facility was renamed after Aline Pimentel on April 4th of 2014. The same day, the federal prosecutor in Rio held the Aline Pimentel case seminar on the right to sexual and reproductive health and maternal mortality in Brazil. And the Aline Pimentel community space was inaugurated in the Hospital Estadual Maggi Mesquita, a state hospital, on April 5th of 2014. The nearly three-year delay between the CEDAW committee's decision and the Brazilian government's agreement to provide reparations to Aline's mother, as well as the continued existence of unsafe and poor quality maternity services in the region where Aline lived, highlight the gaps that often exist between international human rights norms, symbolic state commitments, and on-the-ground policies and results. So what we see with the Aline case is the potential limitations of using international human rights norms to enforce change and results at the national level. While the CEDAW decision was important symbolically, the Brazilian government's failure to implement the decision in a timely manner lessened its intended impact and jeopardized the lives and health of pregnant women in the Baixada Fluminense region, as well as other areas of the country that had maternal health facilities of similarly poor quality. So also, when we think about this decision, reparations is often a touchy subject, right? When we think about slavery or a legal case such as this one. So the Brazilian government was likely very concerned about setting a precedent for paying reparations in cases of maternal death, given the high number of women or the large numbers of women who die every year from preventable pregnancy-related causes. So when we think about the Aline case, human rights scholar and legal scholar Rebecca Cook has noted that the Aline decision was a major advance in the application of human rights law to women's health, since it was the first time that a UN human rights committee decided a maternal mortality case. As Cook argues, in this instance, the committee, quote, identified and analyzed the discriminatory gaps in a country's healthcare system from the perspective of a poor pregnant minority woman. At the same time, you know, that this is a sort of a great analysis, I do think we need to look at how Cook uses this term minority, right? Because as I said earlier, people of African descent are at least 50% of the Brazilian population. But at the same time, despite the size of the African descendant population, social and economic indicators routinely point to its marginalization, right? So in the sense of power, who has power, they are sort of a minority or a minoritized group. The fact that Eleni da Silva Pimentel was a poor Afro-descendant woman played a central role in how she was treated in the public health system and the inferior treatment as well as medical neglect that ultimately led to her death. The Eleni decision recognized the intersectional nature of her health status and underscored the importance of eliminating intersectional discrimination in accessing maternal health services. This recognition constituted an advance in international legal and human rights discourse, since it represents a move away from viewing race, gender, sexuality, class, and other social distinctions as separate and disconnected. Eleni's horrific experiences also indicate that she was subjected to multiple interrelated forms of discrimination, which led to treatment within the healthcare system that differed significantly from that experienced by pregnant, white, middle-class women, especially since women of higher socioeconomic levels are typically able to afford private health care. As a result, many of the challenges that Eleni faced, such as access to an ambulance service and inordinately long waits, likely would have been averted by women who did not depend on the public health system. It's also noteworthy that the first maternal mortality decision by a UN Human Rights Committee involved an African descendant woman, especially since the decision recognized the role of multiple intersecting factors, in this case race and class, in shaping women's vulnerability to maternal mortality, and it was not solely focused on gender. By acknowledging multiple forms of discrimination, this decision opened the possibility of developing more effective ways to recognize, monitor, and address maternal mortality in Brazil as well as in other countries. In this sense, the decision broadly framed the issue of maternal mortality and was relevant to women of diverse backgrounds in many different national contexts. The Eleni decision also highlighted the specific forms of discrimination that women experience due to the physiological and biological requirements of pregnancy and childbirth, which distinguish them from men and make them physically vulnerable in gender-specific ways. So as we think about Eleni and her experiences and ultimately her death, I do think it's important to not only think about her as an individual, but also link her experiences to her social location as a poor African descendant woman who lived in Belford Hoshu, right? So thinking about her structural location, the structural location of her community, which is a predominantly African descendant, low income community. So there was actually a report that was done prior to Eleni's mother receiving the reparations. It was done in 2014. It was at least published in 2014 by the Brazilian Platform on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, Plataforma DESCA. And it found that the health center and maternity services in the region where Eleni lived continued to provide abysmal levels of care to women more than a decade after Eleni's death. And this further pointed to the lack of interest and commitment on the part of local health authorities and public officials in improving institutional and structural conditions and obstetric and maternal health services in the region. Right. So not only did Eleni die in 2002, but even in 2013, 2014, not much had changed. In addition, the municipality of Belford Hoshu, which is located in the Baixada Fluminense region, has historically experienced high levels of state violence, most notably in the form of police homicides of residents. One of the most glaring examples of violence occurred on March 31, 2005, when 29 people were killed in the region. The killings were attributed to a group believed to consist of military police officers who drove through the Baixada Fluminense between 8:30 and 11 o'clock at night, shooting randomly at passersby, and this has been documented in an Amnesty International report from 2005. The massacre was denounced by civil society and human rights organizations. In the Amnesty International report from 2005, Amnesty International found that the massacre was part of a larger pattern of police and state violence against favela communities. The report also highlighted the lack of human rights policing practices and the impunity with which human rights violations by police are treated in Brazil. This publication also underscored the failure of the Brazilian state to protect vulnerable and marginalized communities. Amnesty International argued that violent policing practices criminalized support and treated all members of favela communities as social outcasts whose lives were disposable. The report also found that in the Sapopemba community of Sao Paulo, when residents visited the local hospital, quote, they faced delays in treatment, disrespectful and discriminatory behavior, and were often dismissed as criminals. This finding illustrates the ways in which widespread criminalization of the poor and largely African-descended communities influences access to healthcare and treatment in the healthcare system. So we have the police violence, but we also have the what's often referred to as sort of institutional racism within healthcare, which criminalizes people who go to the public health system seeking treatment. Taking this larger context of police and state violence into account is vital to understanding how Belford Hoshu in the greater Baixada Fluminense region are positioned in relation to the state and state actors with respect to potential as well as actual human rights violations. A noteworthy example of political discourses that link reproduction by poor women and criminality can be seen in statements by Sergio Cabral, who is the former governor of the state of Rio de Janeiro. And so in October 2007, he argued that legalizing abortion was important since it could provide a way to decrease the size of the criminal population. According to an online article, Cabral stated, quote, all you have to do is compare the number of children per month in Lago, Tijuca, Meyer, and Copacabana, which are middle and upper class neighborhoods in Rio de Janeiro, where incomes are similar to those in Sweden, with that of Hocinha, which is the largest poor area of the city, where incomes are at the same levels as Zambia and Gabon. This is a factory for producing marginalized people. To not offer something in the public system for these poor girls to terminate their pregnancies is crazy. And that's the end of the quote. While Sergio Cabral's statements did not explicitly address the issue of maternal mortality, they underscore the devaluation of the lives of women and children who are considered to be incubators and perpetrators of criminal behavior. Cabral's emphasis on terminating the pregnancies of poor women could also be seen as giving little regard for the need to provide adequate or high-quality maternity services to these women or their children. In addition, although Cabral did not make specific references to race, widespread and common sense notions that link criminality to African descendant Brazilians could be easily and subliminally invoked by his statements. His apparent support for abortion is also highly problematic, given the fact that he was essentially advocating pregnancy termination from a controlist perspective, right, in terms of controlling women's reproduction, and thus as a way to decrease the number of poor and unwanted children, in quotes, rather than viewing it as an expression of women's reproductive and bodily autonomy. In terms of this part of my analysis, I am really interested in linking what happened to Aleni to these larger issues of state violence, as I mentioned, right? So the police killings and what can be viewed as practices of genocide against Black communities to show that there is a devaluation of the lives of especially poor Black people in Brazil, which means, you know, that in many ways we need to be looking at the healthcare sector in terms of that and how those beliefs and practices might sort of infiltrate or be transmitted in terms of healthcare practices, particularly in the public health system, the SUS. So João Vargas has discussed what he calls a genocidal continuum that affects life chances and mortality in African diaspora communities. And this is useful in understanding the links between seemingly disparate practices that threaten these communities. It is also important to make connections between these practices and population control and sterilization policies that have limited reproduction by certain Brazilian women, particularly Black Brazilian women. So João Vargas, who's an anthropologist, has argued that we should recognize that in a context defined by racial hierarchies, by white supremacy, apparently neutral policies necessarily become molded by the hegemonic social order. The concepts of symbolic violence and genocidal continuum allow us to understand genocide as part of a constellation of phenomena ranging from everyday forms of individualized discrimination to structural marginalization. Residential segregation, unemployment, and barred access to credit, to the historically persistent killing of those deemed less than human. So Vargas is really arguing in his work that He talks about genocide against Black communities throughout the diaspora, but he's also, I think, developing this concept of genocidal continuum, which means that it's not, certain things might not be viewed as genocide, but they're part of this kind of, this span, right, of genocide, of this continuum, which encompasses a lot of different types of practices which undermine the survival and the well-being of Black communities. Scholars such as Johann Galtung and Paul Farmer have often defined structural violence primarily in reference to diminished life chances that result from poverty. However, it is also important to begin to examine racialized and gendered forms of structural violence, as well as forms of structural violence that result from and perpetuate intersecting practices of discrimination. As can be seen in the institutional experiences and premature death of Eleni Pimentel, intersecting forms of structural violence played a pivotal role in creating conditions that conspired against her life and well-being. Kathleen Ho's work provides a framework for viewing sexism and racism, as well as class-based structures, as mechanisms by which structural violence is enacted and perpetrated. One of the great benefits of the concept of structural violence is the way in which it takes the onus off of individual actors and instead highlights how, quote, violence is built into the structure and shows up as unequal power and consequently as unequal life chances. And that's a quote from Ho. Eleni Pimentel's experiences in Brazil's public health system, like those of countless Afro-Brazilian women, reflected practices of structural violence that were rooted in her social location and closely linked to her human rights capabilities. As Ho observes, quote, when economic and social structures conspire to limit one's agency to the extent that fundamental human rights cannot be met, then structural violence becomes a structural violation of human rights, end quote. I'm going to wrap up. But one of the things I do look at in my work is the lack of an intersectional perspective on human rights, because we have CEDAW, for example, which is the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, and then we have CERD, which is the Convention on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. So we have one on racism and one on gender. But where do Black women fall, right, in terms of that? So we need to start to bring even the human rights instruments together, place them in dialogue with one another. And not a whole lot of work has been done on that. So I'll just conclude by talking about the fact that the Eleni case highlights the urgency of developing an intersectional approach to health and human rights for African descendant women in Brazil and throughout the diaspora. In a Washington Post op-ed published on September 24th, 2015, titled Why Intersectionality Can't Wait, I encourage you to read it. You can just look up the title. Black feminist legal scholar Kimberly Crenshaw responded to recent events, such as the mysterious death of Sandra Bland in a Texas jail cell and other instances of state violence and discrimination directed at Black women in the U.S. Crenshaw highlighted the need for a more complex analysis of issues such as mass incarceration and police homicides that acknowledge the inseparability of race, gender, and other forms of difference. And this photo is from mourners after Sandra Bland's funeral. Crenshaw also noted that nearly three decades after she coined the term intersectionality, women and girls of color in the U.S. continue to be left in the shadows. In addition, Crenshaw argued that the seeming ubiquity of the term intersectionality stands in sharp contrast to the lack of intersectional thinking and practice around critical social issues. Crenshaw's call for intersectional political work and policy solutions is important to keep in mind for scholars, practitioners, and activists alike. While thinking in intersectional terms is not a panacea for all social ills or inequalities, it is an important starting point for bringing greater visibility to the struggles facing African diaspora communities that have long been marginalized, forgotten, and discarded. When coupled with the human rights framework, intersectionality can both advance and complicate our understandings of the mechanisms through which rights are denied and violated, as well as potential solutions to these problems. Thank you.
So my question is, when you separate like the women, you know, the classify the women by the color and everything. So is this really going to help? Because the situation in Brazil with the health care, especially now, is really bad. So, yes, I think it is very important to bring that up. But also, if it should have this, you know, separation, blacks and whites or something.
One of the things I've been looking at and grappling with is the fact that the SUS, Brazil's public health care system, is a universalist system. Everyone has access to health care as a right, as a citizenship right, which is pretty different from the United States. But at the same time, it's hard to sort of see or understand whether people, in this case women of different groups, are receiving equal treatment if we don't have data on just who the patients are. And so although health professionals are supposed to collect color or race based on self-classification, they often don't ask that question. And so just in a basic office visit, people might not know. And then when it comes to maternal death, it also might not be recorded. And there's the issue of having healthcare data on illnesses to really see, okay, are there disparities? Are there major differences in terms of illnesses for the preto, pardo, branco populations? But then also with maternal death, we don't have very good numbers. It's probably getting somewhat better, but it's hard to even understand what has been happening there, although the data that we do have and the studies that have been done do show some pretty big differences. So much higher rates of maternal death amongst black women.
Well, I want to thank everybody for coming.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Dr. Kia Caldwell, Associate Professor of African, African American, and Diaspora Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Dr. Caldwell's lecture was titled The Alini Case, An Intersectional Analysis of Gender, Race, and the Human Right to Health in Brazil, and was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program with support from the Boston University Center for the Humanities and the Latin American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was African American Studies Program Director John Thornton. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Ian McCarn. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.